I walked behind one wagon one day. It was in Germany, and it's a farm, and the wagon had machine gun bullets up one side, and one on the other side, and there's a German nail in there, and turning gray from the cold. And I looked at his finger, he had a wedding band on, and that's the time I got a little emotional. Now, he's dead. All right, he's a German, but he's dead. And what is his family thinking? And they have the same thing with the American.
Welcome to Triumphant Spirit, America's World War II Generation Speaks. This program is a series of broadcasts featuring the stories of a generation that fought and won the Second World War. No matter how they fought the war or where, on the home front or the battlefield, each veteran featured on the program contributed valiantly to a victory that changed the 20th century. Here are their stories in their own words. They are stories of actions and deeds that not only help shape the outcome of the war, but the very world we live in today. During the course of World War II, many military units served in more than one theater of war. Typically, units that served in the European theater of war were transferred to the Pacific theater as the war wound down in Europe. One distinguished unit that went the other way was the 81st Field Artillery Battalion. The 81st was activated at Fort Lewis, Washington in the summer of 1940 and posted to Alaska as part of the Alaska Defense Command. The unit supported actions against the Japanese and the Aleutians, then returned to the States in late 1943 to reorganize as a tractor-drawn 155mm howitzer battalion. The 155mm was one of the largest guns in the U.S. Army's arsenal at the time. The 81st was then sent for combat duty in Europe, landing in Normandy, France, in September 1944. Joining the unit in 1943 was a young 22-year-old milling machine operator from Brooklyn, New York, Ed Terrell, now president of the Monmouth County chapter of the Veterans of the Battle of the Bulge.
All right, now what about D-Day, 6th of June? Where were you when the invasion unfolded in Europe?
I was in the States. I think I was in the States at the time, if I remember right. I'm not sure, but I wasn't over in England when it started.
Right. And what were your feelings when you heard about the invasion?
Come see, come saw. Not too much, really. I was working at the time, and I was yanked out later. By the way, I was drafted. I didn't volunteer. And I left a good job, so what can I tell you?
Your field artillery unit arrived in France across Omaha Beach in Normandy in September of 1944. What were conditions like there, and under what circumstances was your unit committed to battle in Europe?
They worked us slow. We come over, we saw a lot of casualties, cattle and whatnot, blown up, and a lot of damage. But they worked us into Luxembourg just before the Bulge, and it was like a rest camp, really. Not too heavy activity until it started to break. But they moved us in slow, and you got acclimated at a nice pace. You didn't get too excited. It's like starting a new job. You're looking around to see what's going to happen. And I did my little trick as a lineman, and that kept me busy.
Could you describe for us what happened with your unit during the Battle of the Bulge, which took place in the winter of 1944-45?
Sure. When they moved us out that night and we headed in Belgium, I was with the forward party. I think the major was with us from fire direction and two other officers. And we come up on a Belgium road there, snow all over the place, and the officer that was in charge of that area saw our officer and said, "I hope you guys have food, ammunition, and what kind of guns do you have?" And our captain says, "We're howitzer." He says, "Put your howitzer on the road and fire at anything that comes down that highway. We don't know where the lines are." So the our officer said, "We are howitzer. We lob stuff over. We don't fire straight." And the reply was, "I don't care what the hell you are. You blast anything that comes down that road." So from then on in, it was run, run, run.
What were you thinking when you experienced battle during the Battle of the Bulge, and how did your buddies feel?
Well, at the Bulge itself, I was on the phone, fire direction. So I was in a house, an office, a room, never out in the snow, except walking and whatnot. When I was doing my wire laying, I was on the climbing poles and laying wire. So you talk to two or three of the men, that's about it. And I could see what was going on from the position I had in the fire direction. As I got the information from the OP with the infantry, observing...
When you say OP, for our viewers, what is OP?
Oh, that's observation, really. Observation post, where they spy and look at the enemy, call me down in fire direction phone, and gives me a target, coordinates to the target, that's a grid, vertical and horizontal, and when the centers meet, that's supposedly the target area we're going to hit. If we don't hit the target area, we fire a, what they call a smoke bomb. That lets the observer to see where it landed, and if it looks good, he gives an okay for a fire mission. I ask the captain, who was on duty at the time, or this daytime, it's the major on duty, do we fire? And he looks at the map, double checks. You have to count for every round you fire. Did it hit? Did it miss? Or what? He says, "All right, give the command to fire." Now, given the command means there's three other gun operators in the room I'm in, and the other end of their phone is the howitzers, another operator. So I give them the thing, fire, all guns. We had 12 howitzer positions, howitzers, I should say, and they would lob into that. And then the observer would look back and say, "It's a hit, it's a miss, or what?" Or keep firing. And that we'd end that fire mission, keep a record of the coordinates, any for future use, build up in the area. We'd sight them later on and lay in on the Germans. They wouldn't know what the hell hit them because they figure it's a quiet area there. And that's basically what you do in a fire mission. And I found out one day that was just during the bulge, a officer come in with a new type of fuse, had a radio tube in it. Says, "We're just trying this tube for the first time in the bulge. We want to report after you use it. Do not load this fuse on the round. The average round laying ready to be fired through the howitzer, maybe six or seven rounds would be fused the old-fashioned way because they wouldn't go off. This thing," he says, "sends radio waves out like a bat when he's flying around, and they get a reading back. It's a go off when he hits the mast. It's anti-personnel." Next morning, we fire one round, and the phone rings. It's division call. I say, "You fellas, 81st, yeah, I want your coordinates, what you fired at." I give him the coordinates. And he says, "Coordinates is good." "What the hell are you firing?" I said, "Some joker come in with a new fuse." And he says, "Is this new radio fuse?" "Yeah." He says, "Where'd you fire?" I says, "Treetops." "No good." It sent a signal out, that's why it went off, and it looked like friendly fire coming from our round, from our people. So he says, "You have to elevate the guns a couple of millimeters higher. Now, do you have a Piper Cub assigned to you guys?" "Yeah, we have one. He goes up in the daytime." "You get him out of the sky, because you can blow him out." So when they found out what they had, they hand it like you're picking eggs out of a basket. It's a fuse that it's powerful. And we used that one, and another time when I was on, this is all the bars now, I was on night duty, which is the best duty, really, in that place, in the fire direction. It's cozy, it's nice. We get another guy from Sound and Flash. He comes in, he says, I'm from Sound and Flash. He says, what the hell is that? So he says, we think we have a gun that is harassing you. This is nighttime. We harass the enemy with a shell every now and then. It goes off every hour almost. One of the guns assigned to fire at the enemy, keep them awake. They're doing the same thing. So he says, we got the sound, we got the flash, and here's where this guy is located on your map. So he says, what do you want? He says, fire at it, and I want a report. We want to know what we're doing. It's okay. Give them the coordinates to the gun that's involved. Let's say A battery gets all the temporary stuff to fire, and the other guns travels with him while his gun is moving around back and forth. So they do get a battalion fire mission. They're all ready to go. So he fires one round, and we don't get any return. So the officer says, that's good. I said, whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean it's good? He didn't return the fire. I said, this guy's smart like you think he is. He's laying away for the next slob that gets in here, the lob of the stuff in at him. That doesn't mean you hit him. We have no way of telling. You got to stay around here a couple of days. He said, not me. I said, well, that's the way it is. And basically, you got so busy, you didn't have time to think, except PYA, you know, protect your watch your calm. And that was the time, the whole bulge. And then we got a fire mission one morning. And I got the call. I says, what's this here? He says, this is a suspected enemy fire direction. I said, oh, like us? Yeah. And we're going to lay a battalion of rounds down. 12 rounds? You don't even know if it is a enemy fire direction? Yeah. I said, Major, come over here. You have to stay here. I don't. I went out. I'll go back climbing poles. Because they're doing the same thing to us now, right? And we don't know where the shells are coming from. He said, no, you stay here a while. As soon as the snow lets up, you train a man. Now, get this, it's wartime. You train a man, train another soldier. When you have him trained, in fact, you can pick the man. I said, you got to be kidding. So he says, no. You got to remember, I'm an old Army outfit, and this major was... what's the retirement? National Guard. And that's like poison with the old Army. So I got along with him. He said, you pick the man, train like you know what's going on, then you can leave. I said, no, I don't want to leave. They're going to drag me back in there. I'm going to handle ammunition. No, you don't want that. As long as I'm here, he says, you will be where you want to be. And he was right. I go out, and they handed me candy. The rest of the soldiers in the wire section. Because they know I could select somebody now. But I select the guy from service battery. So you never select from your own area. But that was about it. It was rush, rush, rush later on. And then you saw cows blown open, soldiers both sides dead. And as we get in further to the area, we would take over houses in a German town. Not the whole house, one house. The Germans were told, you got an hour in the morning, take care of your cattle and get back. And we want you to go down such and such a house down the street to your neighbor. If they don't take you in, you tell us, and we'll have our interpreter go tell them in German what they got to do. So you're allowed an hour in the house and out. So we had to run to the house. So one day when I was up early, I saw the lady's there. She's digging in the front yard. And she takes out a burlap bag out of the ground. So after she leaves, I dig. I find out it's cured meat. We were on sea rations. So we dug the whole yard up. We had fresh, smoked meat. And we did this with preserves, too. So I says, you got to watch around here. What's going on? And we had little details after the day is over. This is the artillery now I'm talking. And some guy would look for souvenirs, you know. I had the liquor details. Some guys had chickens and eggs. When you're on sea rations, you look for food. Then the order come down, the Germans were poisoned to preserves, and they poisoned cigars. So I opened one bottle, the guy says, don't eat it, Ed. He says, listen, I cork it and pss, you hear that noise come out. This is fresh. This was done last year. They're not poisoned now. So we ate off the land, so to speak.
Ed, after having experienced the Battle of the Bulge,
yeah,
seeing our fellow GIs lying beside the road, many of them motionless, seeing the destruction that the Germans had wrought during the course of the battle, what were your feelings and attitudes toward the Germans themselves when you crossed into Germany?
Well, I saw the same thing over there, only Germans. So I, part of the war, I felt at the time. Don't forget, I was only 22. And as I said before, you watch what you're doing. You can walk into something and, where you don't belong, and the same thing over there. I had mixed feelings, really, for both sides. And I walked behind one wagon one day. It was in Germany, and it's a farm, and the wagon had machine gun bullets up one side, and they went on the other side, and there's a German nail in there, and turning gray from the cold. And I looked at his finger. He had a wedding band on, and that's the time I got a little emotional. Now, he's dead. All right, he's a German, but he's dead. And what is his family thinking? And they have the same thing with the Americans, same condition. But then you got to clock yourself out to have too much of this on your mind, because you got to know what you're doing. And I didn't really worry too much if I'm going to get hit. In fact, when I originally went over to board the jumping around out to board the Queen Elizabeth, I was laying aboard a ship on a duffel bag, and one of the members said, from the south, says, Eddie, I understand you didn't see the Statue of Liberty. I says, no, it's right here. I says, no, I'm tired. I says, I'll see it when I come back. He says, you're what? I says, I'll look at the Statue of Liberty when I come back. You think you'll be back? Yes, my number isn't on it yet, so I'll be back. Don't worry about it. So turn down, you know, it was good. I come back.
When overseas, what did you write your family about when you had the opportunity to write home?
Well, you couldn't say where you were, and there really wasn't too much to say. Send food, cake, and whatnot. And the mail was good. I would say the mail was, considering the way you're moving around, we moved on the average of every 3 days from one position to another position. And that meant picking up wire. We never used radio. And I would have to help with the rest of the wire crew to lay new communication lines in before the battalion could move, strictly on telephone wire. And when we got to 10 miles or 6 miles into the new location, we called back and said, oh, you guys can move. So we were really detached most of the time from the battalion. And so was service battery. Nobody ever talks about service battery. And they're one of the best batteries going. They bring you food, bring you clothes, and bring you ammunition. And they're required just as much as a gunner on a cannoneer. Now, the cannoneer gunners didn't see too much. They were like the infantry or in foxholes. When the enemy picked you up, they'd fire at that gun, and they would have to go in their holes. And I would say they're close as far as infantry goes. And they didn't know what they're firing at. And I had to tell them by way of the observer with the OP.
And you referred to the use of the proximity fuse
right.
A few moments ago. Because your unit was so effective in utilizing that type of artillery shell, your unit was specifically targeted by German artillery for destruction. You were there when the counter-battery fire came in.
Right.
What were your feelings? What were your reactions, knowing that you were being specifically targeted by the German artillery?
It's the next block. If it hits the next block, you don't worry. It's when it gets close. When it gets close, you start to run, and wherever you can. I feel if it has your name on it, you're going to get it. That's the way I felt. At times, I took pictures over when I was over in Europe. I did it in civilian life. I did my own developing. And at one particular time, Belgium, I think, I was developing in the upper deck of a house. I was using soup plates and the old-fashioned developing one single roll of film, and my partner, who's the driver of the wire truck, says, I'm leaving you. You hear what's coming over? This is a counter battery now. I said, it's not hitting us. Stay with me, will you? I don't be here by myself. So he says, no, I'm going down below. I says, George, if it hits the roof, it's going to come down on us. You're going to get it anyway. So help me develop. No, he ran downstairs, come up later after it was over with. He says, how you doing? I said, I'm finished. He says, where's my set of prints? You're at the bottom of the list, I said. You didn't stay with me. But that was my, you know, so-called hobby over here, taking pictures, developing pictures, when you could. Couldn't always take them. I was over there in one camp in Ohrdruf, Germany, where they had what they call displaced persons, displaced people. And they had a little, like a little death camp. All mixture of people, all types. I went back, got my camera in a hurry, took pictures, developed them. And I brought them back to the censoring officer. I knew most of the officers, of course. At basic training, they need somebody to work under a simulated field outside with a smoke pot. And they would give their look through there. This is the howitzer side. And I knew most of them, so I went to the censor office. I said, here's your package of film. I want to get this home to the Daily News. I want to get a scoop on it. He says, no, they don't go home, man. I says, look, you got Stars and Stripes there and Yank Magazine, and you got professionals there. They don't go home. And I was going to say, I'm going to send him home in a helmet, a helmet liner. But I didn't do it. I brought him home. Right? And I still got him. And that's the stuff you don't like to see.
Ed, when you were in that camp, what did you see and how did you feel?
Again, I was taking pictures. I says, the interpreter tells you one thing, you got to make sure he's telling you the right thing. We asked one of the natives there, what happened to these people that were machine gun? I know you got people packed in a shack there with lime on them, head to foot, like the sardines. How about these fellas or these people here that are laying down shot? He said, well, the American infantry was coming, so the Germans machine gunned them. That's nice. In fact, that's the same camp that General Patton has in his diary. He walked in there with Eisenhower and a couple other big generals, and he made the town walk through the area. And this camp is never mentioned, I don't think. And again, I was taking pictures. You try not to get involved, worry about it. You worry about yourself. That's how I felt. And what can I tell you?
Where were you when the war ended, and what were your feelings when you heard that the Germans had surrendered?
Great, because we were ready to go over there to Pacific. We figured we'd go to the United States and back. And we were in the Russian sector. The Russians were going to take over. So we left our network of telephone behind, and we were told, you don't speak to the Russians at all, because it wasn't a friendly setup. And we ended up in Sten, Germany, the American sector. And then they told us where we're going, because half of the guys were in AWOL in this other section. You're not going to the States. You're going directly to Japan. And you know what most of them said? That's their war over there. Let them fight it. We fought ours over here. So they boarded this. I think they put the howitzers on a ship when we went back to Marseille. And that's when they dropped the bomb. And we figured we'd go home then. No, you come off. You don't have enough points now. You go home. You stay here a while. So we did camp duty there until it was our time to go home. But, got home in one piece.
Ed, your generation sacrificed much in the course of fighting World War II. How do you feel about that sacrifice? And would you have anything to say to the current generation that maybe hearing about World War II for the first time?
Well, we're doing a little school, visiting school, and I just started with them. And I find out from talking, this is high school. And when you talk about divisions and armies, doesn't sink in. I found out. Just one setup. Now, the teacher, good history teacher, she knows the background. She's teaching them the Battle of the Bulge. And if you talk divisions, now they just look at you crazy. In fact, one of these students says, how can you fire at one area and cease fire and then fire again? I says, well, you keep records like you kids are doing, like a notebook. We have the coordinates, again, 1 to 10 up. And we save them. And we get a call to refire on it. We refire. He said, how can they fall all at one time? I said, that's technical. It's what you call time on target. You can tell me you have outfits behind you, lands at the same time when you fire off? Yeah. I don't know how they do it, but that's how they do it. It lands at one time. So I says, well, for the sake of argument, say we were firing at Hazlitt. You guys are in Middletown. You have a cross reference now, right? And we fire at Raritan High School, where my daughter works. Then we stop firing. But we save the coordinates. And then there's a buildup in that area. Then I call the captain in. I says, look, the OP has a buildup. These Germans are eating there. They feel it's free. Eating out in the open now, not hiding in the houses. He says, wait till they build up. When we build up, we'll give a division in and everything, any other artillery we can get. We're going to fire time on target. And he says, I'm not giving the order to fire. And I want to go up and look at it and see what it looks like. So he told us the town really literally left up in the air when we gave the okay command to fire with all our firepower in there. And we have a fella in the outfit now that does military research. And I showed him a blown-up map of the Battle of the Bulge, where we were in Luxembourg before we made the push. I said, how come the Germans didn't close us off? We are three-quarter in circle. He says, well, there's two reasons. The dense trees in there, too heavy. And they didn't like the American artillery. You had heavy stuff in there. I says, yeah, we had 240 howitzer, and that's a 14-man gun crew. He said, yeah, too many of that in there. But I said, wouldn't it have been easy to close? No, they're on a push. They have to do it. It's a diversion. That's why they did that. They talk about diversions when they teach in the Army at the beginning, run in the woods for protection. That's okay when the planes are dropping bombs, but not when the artillery fires at you. That's murder, because what the shell doesn't hit, broken branches and split branches hit. So you get a basic training, and it changes later on. And that's why when you mingle, they won't let you mingle with the vets coming back, because the vets are going to say, this is wrong, that's wrong, here's how you do this. They have a program. The program's got to ride the way it is. So when we would catch the enemy going in the woods, we just lob them in.
In talking to the current generation, do you have any lasting words that you'd like to leave as a veteran of World War II?
It was my turn. It may be your turn next time. So do a little reading in history. And if you're going to be drafted, like I was, pick a nice outfit. Stay away from the infantry, because they get their butt kicked. I mean kicked. And stay away from the paratroopers, because eventually later on you get hip problems, leg problems. Pick ordnance would be nice. But learn history. Because you never know when they're going to call for you.